Sveiki atvykę, which is welcome in Lithuanian. Lithuanian. Welcome, everybody, to the Daddy Unscripted podcast. My name is Tim Wheaton. I am the host and the creator of the Daddy Unscripted podcast. Every once in a while, I have to give you this little bit of information. I do my welcomes to the podcast in a different foreign language every episode. So randomly today was Lithuanian. So welcome to all of you people, whether you are from Lithuania or from America. Today, I'm very excited to have this episode out. This is part of my conversation with Matt Thorne, an author and critic from England. Matt was very gracious when I reached out to him via Twitter after locating him and having a couple back and forth discussions with him on there. Basically because I was looking for somebody to finally have a conversation and an episode to talk about Prince. And Matt is a dad, and one of the books that he authored is available through Amazon, which is called Prince, The Man and His Music, which is a book that is straight up my alley, and we'll talk about that book in this episode. And I just wanted to let you know, I am doing this a little bit backwards with the releasing of the two Matt Thorne episodes. His Daddy episode will come out second, and this episode, which I refer to as my Fork in the Road episodes, will be first because it is being released closer to the anniversary of Prince's death. This intro has been recorded a couple of times, and I'm recording this section on April 22nd, the day after the anniversary of Prince's death. Matt and I both talked about when I would be releasing this episode, and I wanted to obviously record it and kind of have it available around the time of the anniversary of Prince's death, but we both agreed that it just wasn't really in great taste. It didn't feel fantastic to us for me to be releasing it during that week or on the day especially. So I've held on to it a little bit and wanted to kind of not really put a weird taste in anybody's mouth or in our own regarding the releasing of this episode. But I am very happy to finally be releasing it to you the week after. As I am speaking all of this right now in Minneapolis, the Prince celebration is going on, and it's been an interesting week. I will just say that. Friday, if you know me personally, you know that I was fully decked out in all purple, including my skivvies. And sorry if that's too much information for some of you. But I listened to Prince all day long. My apologies to Josh, who shares an office with me. But it was an okay day. It wasn't terribly rough. It got a lot rougher towards the night. And I talk about some of that stuff here in this episode with Matt about the impact that Prince had on my life in my youth and still has. I mean, he was a very large, as silly as it seems, because he was somebody I didn't know and he was somebody famous, but he had a very big impact on me when I was 11, 12, 13, you know, through my teenage years, through my very, very formative years. And, you know, if you really had the ultimate pleasure of knowing me during junior high, you may have even experienced me doing a full concert at my friend Mike LaRocchi. It was his girlfriend's birthday, and we were at his house in his backyard, and somehow whispers got out that I knew every Prince move and could do a full concert to the Purple Rain tape, and she wanted to see it so bad for her birthday. This was my first time meeting her, and sure enough, there in front of a bunch of my seventh grade friends and people I'd never met before and some parents, I did a full Prince performance of the Purple Rain soundtrack. So I'm sure pretty embarrassing, but pretty awesome as well. And some people watched the entire thing. So, yes, I am very proud of my Purple Prince heritage in my past, and I was very excited to share a lot of that in this conversation with Matt. So
without further ado, let's get right to the episode with myself and Matt Thorne and our conversation mostly about Prince.
All right, well, we are here today with a very special broadcast. See, you got me all into radio now. episode for the Daddy Unscripted podcast. I am joined today from across the pond, and I'm really hoping that I don't make the very kind of blatant, cliched American jumping into a British accent while I'm talking with you today, Matt.
Well, I'll try not to go mid-Atlantic or full Atlantic as well.
If you do that, it'll probably be way more entertaining than me doing a British accent.
Oh, I don't know.
So we are here today with Matt Thorne, who is a novelist and critic from England. And what part of England are you from again? Just outside London?
No, well, I live in London, but I'm okay. I'm from Bristol originally, which is in the West Country.
Okay. And his, you'll be able to find him on his Twitter under 8 Minutes Idle, which is the name of one of your novels, correct?
Yeah. And it's also a movie. It was made into a film as well.
Oh, fantastic. And we can find that easily or?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's on Amazon. It was on Netflix for a while. I don't know if it still is, but they're both available via Amazon, I think.
Cool. Well, I know what I'm doing tonight then. And you have written a number of three children's books.
Yeah. I've written 6 novels for adults and three novels for children.
That sounds perfect because children are about half the size of an adult. So you've ratioed that out perfectly.
Well, I wrote it. They happen a lot quicker. I wrote the 3 children's books in about 6 months, whereas the novels take me anywhere between. I think about a year was the shortest, but usually about 18 months.
And one of the books, which is sitting on my nightstand currently, is your Prince book, which goes by different titles in the UK and the US.
Yeah, I mean, and also there's a bit of confusion about that as well, because when I was working on the book, when I initially started writing it it's probably about 10 years ago now, the first version, it was referred to in the proposal as Prince the Celebration. And during the 7 years I was writing the book, I thought it'd be braver to sort of drop that. And there were quite a few, I mean, Prince used the word celebration himself a lot. And it sort of felt appropriate, but it also felt like maybe it was seeming as if it was appropriating something he used for himself. So I wanted to make it as simple as possible. And there were a lot of those biographies that came out at the time, like Steve Jobs and various others, where they just used the name of the person. So I thought just calling it Prince I just liked the, that it sort of felt like it summed up. It didn't need anything else. But then when it came out in America, they added The Man and His Music, I think, or The Man and the Music, partly because one of the things about the book is that it's very much a critical study of his music. I mean, there is biographical detail in there, and there are interviews, and there are all the things that maybe you would expect from a biography, but it is very much focused on his music, because I feel that he was somebody whose life was as much to do with his music as anything else. So, I mean, there are times that if you were writing a conventional biography, you might just say, Prince went into the studio every day for 3 years, and it wouldn't really tell you very much because all he did was go into the studio and record another song. So you have to analyze the work and you have to see what he was doing during that time. So I felt that to really get a sort of sense of Prince in the round, as it were, it's important to look at his music alongside his life.
I love the way that you are writing it, or that you did write it. And I'm very big into the technical aspect of digging into a song that way, or a show or a tour or whatever. So I quite like the way that it all has come out in the way that you're writing it. So,
well, thank you very much. I think it is a matter of taste. I mean, I think some people, myself included, you know, I love books about musicians or writers or poets or film directors that really go into the detail in that way. You know, some of the, and I felt that people had done that with Bob Dylan or Neil Young. But I didn't really feel at the time that, obviously I wrote the book before Prince died, but at the time there hadn't been that many Prince books, and it had been a long time since the last one. And I just felt that the people hadn't really written about his music in that way and giving it that sort of care and attention. And also looking at the live performance aspect, because so much of what was incredible about Prince was his live performances and what he did on stage. And I felt that was underrepresented, and people, the books that existed tend to focus on just Purple Rain or, you know, or just the first 10 years. In fact, even now, some of the books that have come out since his death have focused on a particular small period. And I really wanted to try and tackle the whole of his career, and also on the unreleased material, because, you know, he was such a prolific musician, but he also produced an incredible amount of unreleased stuff, some of which, quite a lot of which, is circulating.
Yeah, and there's so much out there, and the difference, you know, since his death, and there have been so many people who are putting out some amazing video footage via Twitter is where I'm seeing most
right,
of it.
Right. Yeah.
And it's just so every night that I do this, I kind of get a look from my wife, because she's like, you're watching Prince videos again. But the difference in his tours and his changes that he made, and not reinventions really, but his evolution, I guess, of the way that he not only portrayed himself, but what he did to some of the songs along the way, is just, it's so huge.
Absolutely. You're lucky to have a tolerant wife as I do, because during the 7 years I was writing the book, some of the time I was traveling around going to watch live performances in different countries, including the States. The most intense period, I think, for me of sort of devotion to the live performances of Prince was when he was playing quite close to my house in the O2 Center, and he was doing 21 nights of shows and 14 or 15 after shows. And I went to 19 of the shows and all but one of the after shows. And these were, you know, it was quite a big commitment, because these shows were starting at about 7:30. He'd play for 2 or 3 hours, and then he'd start the after shows between sort of 11 and 1 o'clock at night. And then sometimes he'd play to 4:30 in the morning, 2 or 3 days a week, including Sundays. So, you know, it was quite one of those things where, you know, my wife was very patient to let me go out and do that. It's before we had children, but it was incredible. When I look back on it now, I think it was an incredible opportunity to see just how the performances developed night after night, because he would, between the first show and the last main show, pretty much everything changed, but it gradually changed over the night. So he would change bits of the set, and the songs would change. But the after shows were almost all completely different. And some nights he'd come out and play like nearly the whole of Chaos and Disorder. Another night he'd come out and do a psychedelic night. Another night he'd come out and do a very sort of almost a heavy metal night with a trio, a power trio. Another night he'd do a jazz show. And you really got to see just the incredible amount of different things that man could do that I don't think people really still realize. You know, it's quite often that people say Prince is a genius, or Prince is great on guitar, or Prince is good at this or that and the other. But for me, one of the most amazing things was that he just doesn't have any parallels as a live performer. And it's not just that he's capable of going out and getting 5-star review shows in a stadium. It's the fact that he was always experimenting and almost working like a kind of independent or underground artist simultaneously.
Yeah. And how many nights or how many days did that 21 night show tour span out there in England?
I think it was about 3 months, because it was like he would play it was like Tuesdays, Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays, but in different orders. And he tried to arrange it so he wouldn't have two shows together, or any more than two shows together, so he could rest his voice and do the next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When he did it out here in LA and they announced it, and I was trying to get tickets to shows and trying to figure out how to be able to go and where we were going to, you know, look for, did we need to be down on the floor or not, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah,
yeah.
And basically just wasted time. But I kept trying to figure out, is this after show counted one of the 21? Like, am I really running out of time, or do I have still 2 weeks to go or not?
Yeah, I think it's quite flexible. I think he sort of decided along the way. I mean, the big LA show I saw was, I went out for, do you remember when he did those three shows in one night? And it was in the Nokia Theater and that complex, and he did the big show. I mean, that was amazing. So he started off with the big show in the big venue, and then moved, I think it was like maybe 2,000 or 5,000, and then moved into a very small club, the Conga Room, which was about 100 people, and then moved into a bigger one that was about 1,000 people. But that, I think that was one of the best shows I ever saw of his. And also coming, well, you know, the other big one was coming out to his house in LA and watching it like literally in his living space. So that obviously was an incredible moment as well.
I remember reading about that. What time frame was that was taking place?
That was in 2006. So basically what happened was my editor had asked me, well, he and I went to a literary event on the future of the short story. I hadn't met him before. He was I'd edited a collection of short stories. And we went to that together and we just hit it off and we were talking a lot. And on the last day I said, you know, I really respect your opinion and everything, but you're not going to respect me now because I'm going back to London this was in 2002, to watch Prince's One Night Alone tour. And he was like, are you kidding? I'm obsessed with Prince. And he was so obsessed with Prince, he used to phone Paisley Park as a teenager and try and get put through to Prince every day. You know, and eventually, I think he got put through to one of the band.
Oh my gosh.
And made his life. So he said, from then on, he said, look, you've got to write a book about Prince. And I was saying, well, I would love to, but I don't want to write a book if he wouldn't like the idea. You know, I mean, I hadn't written a biography before and I felt very uncomfortable because I knew how private he was and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. I spoke to another friend who was a biographer, and he said, look, you've got to approach the musician or whoever it is, first of all, however private they are, because you might be surprised with what comes back. And he said that a lot of times he'd written books and the person he was interviewing or writing about didn't say they would give an interview or didn't give approval, but he got a tacit sort of acknowledgement that it was okay to go ahead. So I sent this letter to Prince, care of his record company, and I was expecting to receive maybe a cease and desist. But instead, I got sent a ticket to LA. I was put up in the Mondrian, and then this car arrived at the hotel and drove me up to his house. And I walked into to the main area there, and there was Jude Law and Bruce Willis and Sharon Stone and David Duchovny and all of these celebrities. And then Prince walks out on stage. I mean, the thing about Prince, you know, that as you'll know, that he would always be late, almost always. You know, the shows are always, they never start when they're supposed to. But it was about 11 o'clock at night, and it just started the minute I walked in. And I didn't realize this until afterwards, but there was supposed to be a very strict hierarchy where it was like Hollywood stars in the front row, then TV stars, then the music people, and then I was supposed to be somewhere at the back. But because I didn't know this, the minute I saw him walk to stage, I ran to the front and stood there sort of literally in front of him. And the band, and in fact there was a guy filming it who came over, and because I'm quite tall, I'm 6'2", and he came over and said, look, all the other celebrities are 5'2", and you're in the way, and you know, your head's blocking the shot, so can you move back? But fortunately that was after the or about, you know, two-thirds of the way through the gig, so I was happy to move back.
So
that was, and then so I watched him play. It was the time he was touring with Tamar, so it started out as a kind of, you know, which is one of his proteges. He started out doing a show with Tamar, with her very much central and him at the back playing guitar, Tamar's bassist. And then after that, about halfway through, he came to the front and then did a sort of full-on Prince set. It was quite a weird period. It was the 3121 album, which that era, which I really like.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of stuff that he played for a while and then disappeared. It was a sort of period of transition. I remember he played an Annie DeFranco song. And there was a few other, yeah, there were sort of To the Teeth, I think it was. There's a few other sort of surprising choices. I mean, as you often got with him. And, you know, and it was one of those things where thinking, okay, well, you know, I would never have heard that song if I hadn't been there that night.
Right.
Because, you know, he never recorded it. No bootlegs have emerged of that evening. And there's so many occasions like that. I mean, a lot of those shows were recorded, and we do have lots of occasions where people did manage to record those moments, but there's so many that are lost, I think. And that was one of the things that I was trying to write about in the book. You know, there were times when he would write like a pastiche song for one of his band to sing, and you'd hear it and you'd just think, okay, this is an old soul song, but it's actually a Prince original, and you would only know, you know, if you know, again, it wasn't recorded, it wasn't, you only find out about it through listening to audience recordings.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be so nice if I don't think it will happen, but it would be so nice if the estate did a really good job on releasing shows, you know, if they went and found which recordings, you know, were out there that were, you know, that were really worth putting out in the best possible quality.
Yeah, and there's that, you know, there's that little whisper that he recorded everything and every concert and every performance and in some way was recorded. And so, like, even if 3/4 of it was recorded, there's that hope that you're holding out that it will come out of the vault and that the estate will release it. But also, like, it's almost got to be like a side, you know, kind of similar to what he was doing before with his own website, because obviously you start releasing a lot of that stuff and it's not going to be highly commercial and there aren't going to be the casual fans who are going to race out to, you know, get their hands on a 2004 concert. But if they were able to find a way to have a site or something like that where people were able to choose and download a lot of the bands that I, because I'm very big into the jam band community, and a lot of them prescribed to that where they are releasing a soundboard/soundboard matrix recording of almost all of their shows, because like Prince, and why I think this could potentially work in their favor, is it's not the same every night. You know, you're not getting the same show every single night. And I know he didn't change his set list up immensely every night, but at least you have a, you know, seasonal thing from each tour or whatever, where they could release a good amount of concert recordings. Those are the ones that I, you know, I want to get some of those remastered and previously unreleased studio stuff. But I also, his performing and performances was such a big part of his career, I think. And kind of like what you were saying, like, that's the stuff that's golden to me that I really want to be able to tap into at some point.
Yeah. I mean, I hear what you're saying about the jam bands. I mean, but for me, like, you know, I mean, I like bands like the Grateful Dead or say Ween, or, you know, that where when you're hearing the performances, I say that's quite similar to Prince, because you don't know which song they're going to go off on.
Right.
You know, so you look at the set list, and sometimes the set list tells you the whole story, and sometimes it only tells you a bit of the story. So, you know, I think the Grateful Dead are probably, and probably Bob Dylan are the two sort of best examples of how to handle that side of things. I don't think, or maybe Miles Davis as well, actually. Maybe Miles Davis is a more instructive example for how Prince's estate may be handled, because you can, you know, it is going to be a smaller audience, you know, as you say. I mean, not everybody's going to want to go out and buy small shows that nobody was interested in. But, you know, it's really worked in the Grateful Dead's favor, I think, over the long time of their career. You know, it's reached the point now where it's really sort of generating money all the time, you know, so you have to have that kind of long-sighted vision for it, I think.
And also, I mean, there's the physical pressing versus the digital, and you know, the Dead did that for a long time with they tried the From the Vault series, and they did, you know, a concert every year or whatever. And then they had one of their inside guys pick a show, and they had all their Dick's Picks series, which that now has a much different meaning in the time of social media. Now you can't really call record releases Dick's Picks and get away with that anymore. But they had that whole series, and a lot of people were buying them. And then they, you know, went through to some of the digital releases. You know, they have different websites that are kind of attributed to that for a number of jam bands or whatever. And there's a, you know, I know that there's a very high level of audience that is seeing a show that, or not seeing a show that is being played, watching the set list, you know, on Twitter as it's being released. And as soon as it is hitting the internet, they're rushing out and paying the $8 or whatever it is for an MP3 download. You know, that's a low, very low cost to the band avenue for them to get that music out. And it just continues to perpetuate the machine, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that was one of the things that maybe people don't necessarily realize about Prince, was that he had that same thing of people, you know, tweeting about the songs he was playing, you know, song by song, people being on the internet very keen to know what he was performing. I mean, it was particularly like, for example, when he came over here to do the Third Eye Girl shows, and you had no idea what he was going to do, and it was, you know, incredibly exciting. And you know, I mean, one of my favorite Prince songs is this song called Wasted Kisses that he only played live one time at one, you know, one after show. And there are lots of times like that, you know, that literally this is the only time he's going to perform that song. But also things like when he would jam on Billy Cobham's Stratus, you know, I mean, that often was one of the most exciting parts of a show, was hearing him do, you know, how he would improvise with this song, you know, him, you know, the same way that watching Miles Davis would be.
It just makes, it gives me goosebumps to think about them doing something like that. But time will tell with all things that they've got going on. I know the estate has a billion things probably coming at them right now. So,
no, I know. I mean, and it's disappointing. I mean, I say that, we don't know, who knows, they may surprise us yet. I haven't heard, you know, sort of final confirmation about what will be on that Purple Rain remaster box set.
The second disc or whatever, or
well, I think it might be four or five discs, but I've heard that it might.
Really?
Yeah, I've heard it may include two live shows, full live shows. Mm. So that seems like, you know, the right way to go to begin with. So if they can carry on like that, I mean, if that's true, and then if they carry on doing that with other tours, I think that might actually be really great. But I mean, ideally it would get to a point, I'd love to see it at a point where they were putting out, you know, just as you say, just sort of random shows. You know, here's one from 2004, here's one from 83, here's one from, you know, 92, and you sort of find the interest in the shows. I mean, there is something that they've been doing, that the estate's been doing, that's quite interesting to me, where they've been showing live shows at Paisley Park. I think these are video recordings, and they seem to be choosing them quite eclectically, so that's mm-hmm. sort of quite interesting. You know, I looked at it the other night, and it seemed that they were showing a musicology show, and then, you know, and then they were showing a Love Sexy show. So it seemed, I mean, you know, obviously those are big shows, and maybe the ones that you would think of, but it still seemed they weren't shows, as far as I'm aware, that have been widely released before. So maybe if they can do something like that at some point, then that would be fantastic. I mean, I'd love the idea of, yeah, I mean, the Dead are the main example, I think, of, you know, just going there and having 30 print shows coming up and trying to decide which one you obviously end up getting all of them, but, you know, which one would you go for first?
Exactly.
You
know? Yeah, that's the way it would work out pretty much.
I also think the same way as with the jam bands, you know, it's sort of the whole show that's interesting. So you wouldn't want sort of edited highlights, but you'd want to hear how the set developed over a whole night.
Yeah. And I think the potential, like, if they were to do this, I mean, this is a huge if, or when you talk to the right people, Matt, and make this happen.
Be nice to think I had that power, but I don't.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But if they were to do some of those nights, and I know he didn't just do that during the 21 night performances, but I think a night like that tells a story, like that night you were talking about, where it's three shows in one night, you know, to be able to box up something as, you know, March 4th, 2012, and have it be the two shows that he played or whatever, or
yeah.
There's so many possibilities. So we are officially, Matt and Tim are now throwing our hat into the mix to take over the live recording releases and do it in a way that everybody would just gobble up, obviously.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's a dream. It would be a dream job, wouldn't it? You know, to sort of sitting there and go through the shows. Oh my God.
That would be ridiculous. I mean, that's the thing, is you talk about how much material he has recorded and how many, I've thought about this so many times, how many people do they have going through and listening to it to see what they are going to do with each individual item, and what is that person's level of knowledge, and, you know, who are these people that are doing all of this? It's we'll know in time, I guess.
I was talking to Lee Ronaldo, Sonic Youth, and they did this thing where they got a sort of intern, I think it was, to go through all of their recordings and work out which ones to put out. And, you know, it's sort of, and I don't think very much has come out yet. I think they've got more to, they're looking at. I mean, they've put out a couple of things, but again, it's that thing of, like, what's it like to sit there and do that? You know, to be a Prince fan and be given keys to all of those recordings would be quite something.
Yeah, that would, you obviously have to have very good standing with them. And I mean, potentially be somebody who's already done some of his mixing or mastering before. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, but if you look at, like, with Dylan, when they got Clinton Halen advising them, which I think was a really smart thing for the management to do, where they've got somebody, you know, who basically knew everything there was to know about Dylan, and he could tell them where the recordings were and what they were missing, and then they could work out how to release it. And I hope that the Prince estate does something similar. You know, they don't just go for, because obviously you want somebody with audio experience, but equally you want somebody who knows what they're doing and knows their way around the the back catalogue and why things are interesting.
Yeah, it's a humongous task. And I mean, we say how it would be a dream job, but you also would have a pretty decent amount of pressure as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, and also the thing is, it's you know, how they work out how to do it, whether they do, you know, how quickly they release stuff, whether they, you know, they just put it out very regularly, or if they do it, you know, working out what the tolerance for it is, I guess.
Yeah, and figuring out how much people are going to consume. And we've given them a kickstart here today, so at least they know two people
would be out there with their money. Yeah. But, you know, I'm mad like that. You know, I love live recordings of almost every, even bands I don't like, I'm interested in their live recordings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously something very different from, I remember kind of one of my, and I'm about to slam a band here, sorry, but I remember, like, I don't remember when it was or whatever, but I think this was the first time that it really struck me in this way when I saw Blink 182 performing on some award show or something, and their vocals were so bad. And it might have just been an off day. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I have not seen them live before, whatever. But the vocals were just so completely awful. And I remember sitting with a couple of people and we were like, wow, they obviously have an amazing producer and whoever is working in the studio with them, because they cannot sing at all. So that's the flip side of a live performance. But it's good to get the energy and see what a band brings. And
well, the thing about Prince, though, is even when Prince was struggling with his vocals, the shows could be really interesting. You know, there was one show where he had a really bad cold, and he you would say from anyone else, from a technical point of view, this wouldn't be an interesting show. But instead, he sang different songs. He sang them in a different way. So it was in 92, and it was a really interesting show. You know, so you know, that's one of the things about him where, you know, even the things that you might say as a sound technician, you'd say he wouldn't put it out because it isn't top quality, but it is interesting in itself.
Yeah. And because you talked about the Dead earlier, I will say there's, and because I know you love live performances, and I don't know if you know about this or not, but I think it was the beginning of 1978 or 1977, but there was a 3-show stretch at the very beginning of the year where Jerry Garcia had laryngitis and he couldn't sing at all. And they did all of the other songwriter, Bob Weir's songs. And so for a lot of people, like, they were probably going to those shows or whatever and thinking, what the hell, like, this is going to suck. No offense to Bobby, but,
sure.
But you could tell. And I loved those concerts because Jerry was just ripping it up on guitar because it was all he could do, you know, and it kind of made you, or made him, work a little bit harder at the other things that he was able to do, and to be able to have his quote unquote voice be stronger in those shows by his guitar.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, and Prince did similar things. There was that show in Louisville where the horns hadn't shown up. So on the One Night Alone tour, so he rearranged it to make it much more of a piano show, and that's a, you know, that's a one of a kind show, and that's the sort of thing I'd love to see them put out. So you could say, you know, yes, you've seen that, you've already had the One Night Alone box set, but there was this night that he did something very different, never to be repeated, purely thinking in the moment and coming up with a completely different experience. You know, you know, those are the sort of things that other musicians just don't do. They would have cancelled the show, or, you know, they wouldn't have tried to think of a creative way around it.
Right.
As Prince and the Dead did in both those instances.
Yeah, that's part of, I really am hoping that they release at least one good version of the piano on a microphone tour, because those, the little bits that I have seen from it are just so compelling, and obviously all the more so because of what age it was in his life, but just his different composition and the way that he changed things. You know, I like to go through every once in a while and pick out a year and listen for those songs that he completely altered from where they started as either the studio version, or even how much different little things would become in the live version. That's what, one of the many, many things that I loved about his performing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you know, I also really like the way certain musicians would have an impact on him. So, for example, when he started working with Frédéric Yonnet, who's a harmonica player, you know, and those shows, are completely different, because it was really odd to have, you know, suddenly have a harmonica in the band.
Mm-hmm.
And it made him, you know, and it made him reinvent songs that had been very predictable, things like Cream.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd never heard a good version of Cream before. And then suddenly when he had Yonne in the band, he sort of turned it into a 15-minute jazz song and completely transformed it. You know, and that was one of those songs, if you'd said to me, which Prince song will he never, you know, will you never get an interesting version of? It would have been that. And then suddenly, you know, here he was turning it around, changing it completely.
Yeah. It's funny. During that just made me think of something during the couple of year, I guess she probably moved away a year or so before he died. But Rabia, who was she, I don't know if she was Diamond or if she was Pearl, but Rabia was a neighbor of mine for a little over a year. And I can't remember. She had a little girl, and she would come out, and we have a little grass area that's not too far from our house. And a bunch of the moms in our neighborhood would go out there and bring their little kids, and everybody would play and everybody would talk and whatever. And I don't know what she said, but one day she said something to one of the moms, and all of the moms started Googling her that night and trying to find out who she was and what she had been in. And actually, I think it was because of her time being on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So they started, you know, kind of talking about that a little bit with her. And it was a few months after that something happened where my wife, like, when I came home from work, verbally assaulted me with the information about who she was. And I was kind of flipping out, and I really held it in inside. I don't know how I did it, but I don't think I ever had a conversation at all with her about Prince. I know the moms did, and they, you know, a couple times my wife would say how she said what an amazing person he was and how great it was. And her life has changed dramatically. Like, she became a born again Christian and like is a motivational speaker now and is just very different from who she was when she was with him. But she talked about him like he was the greatest person on the planet and really, you know, made you feel good about all of the things that she had to say about him. But I really wish that I would have just at one point said, all right, I'm going to get this all out. We're going to have a long conversation today. But I never got that chance. Blew it.
I'm very envious of you. And it's one of those things where a lot of the connections in the book, a lot of the people that I talked to came about through talking to people and friends and finding out people who had connections with Prince that were quite surprising, you know, sort of, you know, so a lot of the times there would be odd connections. Like, you know, there's a guy at the university where I teach called Frank Griffiths, who's a saxophonist, and he was friends with Claire Fisher. So he put me in touch with Claire Fisher. There was another, a mum at the school. She knew this guy, Chris Poole, who was Prince's UK manager for a while. I had a friend who was a screenwriter in LA who knew Wendy and Lisa and said that they would be willing to talk. So a lot of that, you know, a lot of it, I mean, part of the 7 years of writing the book, part of it was just the actual listening to all the material, but a lot of it was equally sort of waiting for interviews, and they sort of started to come together, and they started to come in clumps. And that's when I started to feel that, you know, maybe there was a reason. I really wasn't sure whether I was going to, even though what I'd sort of taken, you know, done the deal and taken the money for the book, I didn't know. I was, for a long period, I was thinking of giving the money back, because I was just thinking that this is such a big project. Mm. And I really didn't want to publish a book on Prince unless I felt it was worthy of him. And I reached a point where I said, okay, well, if I get enough people who've worked with him to talk about him in an interesting way, then that will be justification for it. And then when some of them started to die as well, or, you know, or realized that they, or said that they wouldn't speak again, or, you know, it sort of felt like this, okay, this is the only record that there's going to be of this moment, and no matter what happens in the future, and obviously I didn't expect Prince to die, but I thought, you know, this is history and it's worth recording.
Right. So I was fully expecting us to start on the whole dad side, but I just kind of let us go on this. But how did you, I get asked this question as well, but how did you, as a white boy in England, get your start with Prince? Like, how did you fall into him at all? And let me clarify and specify with that, because I completely agree and know that Prince transcends race.
Yeah, yeah.
He transcends sex.
or gender. Well, he transcends sex, but gender and a little bit age as well, obviously. So I ask this question with that clearly in mind.
Well, it started with Purple Rain, both in the playground. People were playing at the playground, but also my mum had it at home. She used to buy these cassettes that would have the hits of the day. They'd have about 10 songs, and on one of these tapes there was When Doves Cry. So I was listening to that a lot. And then it was really Sign the Times was the one where I sort of discovered it for myself. It was because of the age. You know, I was 10 when Purple Rain came out and 13 when Sign the Times came out. So, you know, I regret not being, you know, I was too little at the time to, you know, to get into him with album one. And I think, you know, if I had been of age at that time, I would have done. But instead, it was Sign the Times that really hit me. And then I went back. Well, actually, before I went back and bought all the other albums, the first thing was just discovering a bootleg, you know, because I was listening to the album over and over again and trying to make sense of it. And I think it's an incredibly cryptic album. I think even to this day, I don't fully understand it. And that's one of the things I love about it. But there are a lot of references on it that, you know, as I was very into literature as well at the same time, you know, there seemed a lot of symbolism that was a bit inexplicable. And one of those things was the crystal ball, you know, going to the crystal ball. What was the crystal ball? You know, why are they singing about the crystal ball? And then I went and went to the record shop a couple of weeks after Sign the Times came out, and they had this box vinyl set of an album of a bootleg album called The Royal Jewels. And on The Royal Jewels, I noticed on the back there was, well, it had a description on the back. It was describing Prince's studio setup and saying that he was recording in the middle of the night and he had all his band on call. And as a young sort of writer writing in the middle of the night, it seemed like such an incredibly romantic idea. You know, I just couldn't believe it. I mean, obviously, there was a bit of exaggeration to it because he didn't literally have his musicians there. Sometimes he did, but, you know, they weren't, the way I was imagining it was probably more romantic than the reality of it. But on that album was the song Crystal Ball. And I heard that and I just thought, okay, right, now I'm obsessed. And from then on, well, actually, I mean, the big question for me was how he got from that material to Love Sexy. And there seems such a sonic leap, you know, in every sense, from what he was doing on Sign the Times and the albums before that.
Yeah.
To Love Sexy. And I think, you know, part of that was because those records were coming together piecemeal. You know, there were songs on Sign the Times dating back, something like Strange Relationship, I think dates back to 82, you know, it had gone through various permutations. So it didn't feel like an organic movement. You know, I couldn't understand how one year he's recording Sign the Times and then the next year he's doing Love Sexy with such a different sound and so completely different and no kind of continuation in the two styles. And of course, it's because Sign the Times was lots of different songs from lots of different eras brought together, and Love Sexy was one concentrated burst of recording.
Right.
So that answering that question was something that aesthetically, you know, has interested me ever since. And that sort of is at the root of the book, really, was sort of working out how he went from one style and one group of people to the next. And then, you know, and then you sort of backtrack and work out, well, what happened with the revolution and, you know, and sort of, and then go forward, you know, how does he end up, you know, sort of things like Diamonds and Pearls seem such a left field turn, and Graffiti Bridge, half of it feels good, but some of it feels terrible, you know? So it's sort of, and it's like, well, why is some of it terrible? And, you know, and then working out that, okay, well, it's because, again, it was like much older material, but it was stuff that some of it was, and some of it he'd written when he was past his, you know, his kind of great moment where everything seemed to turn to gold. And it was piecemeal. Again, it was like, you know, it was like Sign the Times comes together piecemeal, but it feels organic, whereas Graffiti Bridge is piecemeal and it feels piecemeal.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Sign of the Times has such a, like, that's the perfect word for it. It feels so organic. And I think Purple Rain, even if you, which it's very difficult to do, but if you take the film out of it completely and just listen to the album as it is, it's so, it's kind of Sign of the Timesy in that way to me, where it just, everything just fits together so perfectly. And even the albums before that kind of don't really, you know, and that's what I kind of loved about those as well. They have so many differences in them. I mean, his self-titled album, like going from, you know, love song to a punk, basically a punk song to something back to a love, almost disco song, is just so varied. But Purple Rain, pretty much, I mean, there's a little bit of some difference, but it just all fits together. And I think that was what Sign of the Times kind of sounded like to me. But I'm just a little bit older than you.
Mm-hmm.
So when Purple Rain was out, I was 12, and I remember having the vinyl of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember sitting on my couch, and my dad was a pastor, and sitting on the couch reading through the lyrics. And I remember my dad asking to see it, and me just taking this big, huge gasp and basically waiting to have Prince shut down in my life and mm-hmm. for him to say, you can never listen to this guy again. But I guess he looked at all the wrong songs or the right ones and just kind of handed it back to me. And I think a little bit of that played into my need for more, pretty much, you know, knowing at that age, at 12 and 13, that I was listening to dance music, sex, romance, and, you know, Let's Pretend We're Married and
right, yeah.
Head. I mean, I was listening to those over and over, and all of these songs that I really shouldn't be listening to. It was just at the perfect time for this white kid in Southern California whose parents are like super conservative Christians to be like listening to these things that are so naughty. And still kind of not really getting them, you know. I remember I knew a little bit of what was going on, but not entirely because of how good he was with hiding a lot of it or making it, you know, so much of it innuendo or whatever. But there obviously is the blatant in your face stuff as well.
Yeah, it's weird because, I mean, with my parents, my dad just doesn't like music at all. He's never been interested in music. But my mum loves music, but she, you know, she loves the Stones and Rod Stewart and you know, sort of rockers. She likes sort of hard rock. But for some reason, Prince never worked for her. You know, she didn't get it, and she didn't really like, I don't think she liked the way he looked, you know, and it just was somebody that just didn't really impact for her in the same way. I think also maybe the sort of femininity of it as well, you know, that she was somebody who liked the sort of the much more kind of heavier, harder music. So mm-hmm. so there was never any question of, you know, sort of my parents worrying about me listening to it because, you know, she was listening to, you know, Goat's Head Soup or whatever, you know, had heard
right,
all the,
right,
you know,
right.
But there was a sense that she just didn't understand it. And I think even now, you know, I think they're both quite perplexed that I spent, you know, so long writing a book about someone. I mean, they don't think he's terrible. They just don't get it. You know, they don't hear. I mean, the one time I did this one radio show where I played some of his more obscure music and talked about that. And she listened to that and she was like, oh yeah, there were some songs on there that I thought were okay. But he didn't really do it for her in that way. He just wasn't somebody that she admired. I think if she had been really into it, it might have put me off. So I'm quite glad in a way.
You wouldn't have enjoyed it as much. Oh, my mom likes this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So your mom is kind of like the Rolling Stones fans out here that did not like Prince.
Yeah, she would have been booing and throwing things, I think. In fact, she went to see the Stones. Both of my parents went to see the Stones in 82 in England, but it wasn't Prince. It was George Thorogood and the Destroyers, which, you know, it shows the sort of
audience. A much better match.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. My wife's uncle was actually at that show because he's a humongous Rolling Stones fan. And every once in a while, usually when I go to a family event with a Prince t-shirt on, he'll come up and tell me that story all over again about all of them basically booing him off the stage. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's terrible. And you know, and it shows the sort of, you know, the sort of close-mindedness, you know, of a certain type of rock fan that they couldn't really accept what he was offering.
Yeah, so I'll kind of finish out our Prince stuff with some lists. Aside from, well, no, you can include whatever you want, but what would be your top five, not in any necessary order, Prince albums?
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say songs. Okay. Albums. So I'll do it in order. I'll try and do it in order. Joint number one would be Love Sexy and Sign of the Times. I think that, you know, they're the sort of pinnacle for me. Mm-hmm. And then number three would be probably Dirty Mind, and then 1999, and then probably Around the World in a Day. But it's one that was the album for me that really came alive in writing the book. It was what, you know, it was the one mm-hmm. where, I mean, that and Parade, they were both albums. I mean, I like both the albums, but they, they sort of gain the more you know about them.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the other albums, you know, the actual process of composition doesn't necessarily change your opinion of them, but knowing what he was going through, knowing the way that sort of Around the World in a Day started off with Paisley Park, the song, and it was originally going to be called Paisley Park. And, you know, it sort of started off almost like a kind of post-success album, you know, sort of like almost like an on-the-road album, and then slowly became the much more abstract, much weirder record that it is. And you know, just the musicianship of the rest of the Revolution on that record, I really love as well. And then the same with Parade. It's like, you know, I love the fact that the original demos were so skeletal, and then he got Clare Fisher involved, and then he added the orchestral arrangements to it, and then sort of mixed it around again and changed it around. So it's sort of those, I mean, that's six, so I'll leave off Parade. But yeah, I mean, those would be my favorites, I think. But I could, you know, I mean, I could find, it's almost easier to do the ones I don't like, you know, I mean, I can find almost anything, you know, any day other albums could raise higher. I mean, the one that I have never really understood why other people love it so much, The Gold Experience. I've been listening again to that recently, and it really stands up in an odd way. I mean, it's an odd, because of the songs that aren't on it, there's a sort of a version of that that's in my head that's perfect, that it doesn't have in reality because of some of the songs that he took off it, a bit like Dylan albums, you know, when he takes off the best songs at the last minute. But, you know, that's an album that I'd put pretty low down, but even that, you know, sort of improves the more you listen to it.
Yeah, I think I would have to share that sentiment. And maybe some people are turned on more by it because of The Most Beautiful Girl in the World. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So I'll let you cheat on this one if you have to get off your phone. I mean, get on your phone, sorry.
Go on.
To do a top five list from 19, because of how you did yours, I will say from 1996 on.
Okay. All right. I'll try and do it not on my phone. Is it top five, you say?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll try. And then if I need to cheat, I will do. So number one would be Wasted Kisses, which I think is just after the cutoff point. You know, it's on New Power Soul. And I love that one because it was just so unexpected. You know, it was a hidden track and it's theatrical and it's got a story to it and it's incredibly dark and weird and it's got all these associations that people argue about whether or not it has or not. And it was just, you know, it just shows how many surprises there are in Prince's catalogue because it's, you know, not a particularly good album. Although I think it's better than, you know, people make out. But in fact, it started off as a Prince album and then he decided not to make it a Prince album because it wasn't going the way he wanted to. So he made it a New Power Generation album instead, mm-hmm. although it's got Prince on the cover, so it feels very much like it is a Prince album. And then you're listening to it, and it all seems of a piece, and then suddenly this incredible song comes at the end. So that would be number one. Number two would be Beautiful Strange, off of the remix version of Raven to the Joy Fantastic. Again, you know, another incredible song that was a surprise, you know, that you didn't, you know, I don't really like Raven to the Joy Fantastic particularly. And then, you know, suddenly he remixes it and comes up with something absolutely incredible and puts in this song that, you know, should be much better known. And hearing that live, you know, was great. You know, it was a really exciting moment. Number three would be Xenophobia from the One Night Alone tour. It's on, I think it's on the live album. You know, a long jazz instrumental, mainly inspired by, you know, kind of fairly pedestrian thing of Prince not wanting to take off his shoes at airports. But he goes from that to terrorism and fear of strangers and others. And, you know, and it's also quite a hard jazz track. You know, I mean, it's quite, a lot of Prince, people don't like a lot of Prince's jazz music because it's seen as soft or elevator music or Muzak or whatever. But I think that one's one that's actually quite hard and quite interesting. 3121, mainly for, and you'll understand this as a Grateful Dead fan and a jam band fan, that song was a huge leaping off point for Prince from 2006 onwards. Whenever he played it live, he would do it in so many different ways. And he would weave in When the Saints Go Marching In, he would weave in Down by the Riverside, there were two versions of it. There was 3121 and there's 3121 Jam. And he would just, you know, go all over the shop and really do an incredible musical workout. And then finally, I think, am I up to five?
Yeah, I think so.
So for five, I'm going to go for, and this is a real left field one, the song Prince and the Band, which he never recorded a studio, well, he did record a studio version of it, but it was never released. but he played it live hundreds of times, and he played it coming out of the song Musicology often. So he'd play the song Musicology, and then it would become this other song called Prince and the Band, where he would slag off record labels. He'd talk about tax avoidance schemes. He'd talk about the band. It was a bit like, sort of had a James Brown quality. It also had a kind of Graham Central Station introducing the band type quality. It sort of fit similar to The Jam, you know, that song that they did. And it just seeing him, whenever he played that, like, you know, I'd watch him play Musicology and just think, oh, please go into, you know, into Prince and the Band. And sometimes, he would then go into play that, you know, play that Funky Music White Boy, a cover of that. And then another song. And then, you know, and this would be like those sort of Grateful Dead moments where, you know, they're going off and doing, playing in the band or whatever, you know, a sort of 20-minute improvisation where he was going in and out of different songs. And there's a really, my absolute favorite version of it is on, or rather was at the Indigo nightclub where he, during that, the O2 stint, where the rest of the, it was a performance where he'd done Around the World in a Day and A Whole Lot of Love, and he'd done a lot, and it was really sort of heavy psychedelic show, and Party Up, I think he did. He did it, I can't remember exactly which Dirty Mind song he did that, and I think it was Party Up. And then at the very end of the show, he goes into Musicology and Prince and the Band and was just having such fun with it. And, you know, he had the entire room eating out of his hand. And, you know, just watching him do that with a song that nobody really knew, you know, I mean, the audience did because they're diehard, or some of the audience did because they're diehard fans. But you'd think he was playing, you know, Purple Rain or something, because people were just going absolutely crazy and just seeing him, seeing the sort of the fun he had with that.
I like hearing that, hearing your different takes on that, because a lot of his later stuff is so, I don't know, misconstrued, and a lot of it is difficult to connect with and attach to. And, you know, a lot of the albums are kind of, even the way that the Gold Experience is, they're just kind of in his brain space of seemingly, I'm going to do what I want to do, and I'm going to record it. And, but there is so much good stuff that is still in all of that. I mean, even in his last two albums, anybody listening, don't at me for saying this, but you know, a lot of those songs from those last few albums are the ones that I will really crank up in my car when I'm driving somewhere, you know. And a lot of that is because some of those are kind of those more rocking Prince songs for me that I enjoy. But I think a lot of people don't spend enough time in the later music. And I think that I made a very, after he died, that was one of my first things that I did, was delve into some of that later stuff that I had not given a ton of time to previously. So,
yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, like Hit and Run Phase 2, I think is a, you know, it's a great album. I love almost everything on that. But then Hit and Run Phase 1, I'm sort of less keen on, but I feel that that's one that's going to grow in the future. But that song, The X's Face, on the album, I really, you know, I think that's one of the last of his really great songs. And there was, you know, but there was also loads of stuff that didn't end up on those records. You know, I mean, there were a lot of sort of quite dark love songs that he, you know, that he was putting out. Ain't Gonna Miss You When You're Gone. The Bourgeoisie, you know, he was writing some really quite, I mean, that some of that later stuff is, you know, the very late stuff is very savage, very peculiar, and, you know, and almost completely forgotten. And, you know, like a song like Groovy Potential that's on, you know, that is on the Hit and Run, the second Hit and Run album. I mean, that song, I mean, I love that song. I think it's one, a really great late track, but it almost disappeared. You know, I mean, it was sort of, you know, I mean, I think the choice between what went on Hit and Run Phase 2 and what didn't seems to me almost quite arbitrary. It's a bit like back when he was doing the Slaughterhouse and the Chocolate Invasion, you know, that they, you know, where, you know, there was some stuff that, you know, he didn't, his process was public. I mean, the thing is, when he was recording, if he'd put out everything that he was recording around the time of Sign of the Times, it would have seemed incredibly eccentric and, you know, it would be impossible to make sense of. If you put all of the songs that he was doing around the Slaughterhouse and the Chocolate Invasion era, there's some stuff that is completely out there and completely mad and, you know, and it's clearly just a lark in the studio. And the same with that last period. But then every now and again, there's some really incredible, great songs. And, you know, we have them now. We, you know, because he was putting them out, you know, it wasn't just bootlegs. He was putting them out officially. So you'd have the singles or the downloads or whatever, you know, and you could see when he chose to go back to something and work on it, and he discarded something, and some of the things that he discarded were as worthy as the things that he carried on working on.
Yeah. Well, I think we've covered Prince significantly.
Very enjoyably, I must say. It's great fun. I've enjoyed that.
We could probably do that for hours and hours.
Days and days.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, you can find Matt at 8 Minutes Idle on Twitter. You can look him up on Amazon for his novels, Matt Thorne. That's got an E at the end. So look up Matt and make sure you, if you are as kooky for Prince as I am, or even want to be able to do a much different examination of his life and his music, because he is one of those that is not just writing songs to write songs. Like, a lot of his work is so personal, and so that is what I think makes that kind of a book and something that is so sizable as well to be so entertaining and informative as well, as because you're getting such a good look into him through his performances and through different songs and albums. So again, for you people here in the US, I believe it is called Prince, The Man and His Music.
Yeah, that's correct. And can I just quickly say about that, you know, that I very much view the book as a start of a conversation, you know. So I like to hear from people who've read it and are listening to the songs. And, you know, it's one of those things where people will disagree about certain shows. There'll be shows that I say are fantastic that other people think are rubbish, or certain songs that I'm rude in the book about. I think there's only one song that I was slightly dismissive of in the early period, which was Tambourine. And I saw these people going, how can he say that Tambourine's a bad song? And all I was saying was that for me, Tambourine wasn't the best song on the album or whatever, you know. So, you know, it's the start of a conversation, and hopefully it will, you know, for all Prince fans, from people who've listened to every single scrap of unreleased material to people who've listened to one album, you know, hopefully we'll find something to entertain them or to argue with or agree with or whatever in the book.
I think I'm waiting for a world where, kind of like a museum walkthrough, where we can read your book and like push a button and listen to the song that you are describing, because there are some that you can't find easily or whatever. So if somebody can also collaborate with Prince's estate and Matt and make that happen,
that would be great.
That's a gold mine right there. Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, it felt important that I should cover every single song, you know, that we know about, you know. So I tried to do that, because there are so many secret and interesting and unusual songs that he recorded that just really aren't known, you know. So I wanted to make sure that was there, that it covers everything.
Yeah, no, that's great too. I think especially because then for many people like me, like, it gives me the drive to seek that out. And then I become the Indiana Jones of Prince music,
yeah,
you know, looking for these things to be able to have that conversation.
Well, you know, it was the same for me too. You know, I mean, I had to, you know, go out and stay in, you know, and bid on eBay for that 7-inch with the Whistling Kenny B-side, or find all those shows.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was fantastic having that conversation with you, Matt. I appreciate your knowledge coming into play on all things Prince. And I'm very humbled to be able to have somebody that I can speak with in regards to the man who, I mean, changed so many lives, changed my life, obviously is a big part of your life as well. So thank you.
No, thank you. It's really enjoyable. It's one of the most enjoyable interviews I've done, I think.
Ah, take that, everybody else.
And I don't know, so again, that. It's not like, you know, not like, you know, Chicago's the best audience.
That's at the end of all of his interviews. Well, thank you for that.
Yeah.
There you have it, our conversation about Prince, which is kind of funny that I am releasing them in this way, which is actually the way the conversation went. I normally do my episodes and my recordings and my conversations with people where we talk about the whole daddy side first, and then if we have a conversation about something else, it takes place after, and that's the way I release the episodes. But in this case, we kind of rolled straight into the Prince conversation, and we did that whole episode, and then we kind of took a little break, and then we went into his daddy episode. So again, huge,
tremendous, enormous thanks to Matt for spending a late night on his side of the pond having this long conversation with me. It was a fantastic conversation and felt like I was just having a long talk with a great guy, which is what a lot of these are, and I hope you guys are getting that out of that as well. So you can find Matt on Twitter, 8 Minutes Idle, the number 8. You can find him and all of his books on Amazon, Matt Thorne with an E at the end. You can find Daddy Unscripted on iTunes, on Stitcher Radio, on Google Play for you Android users. And you can find us on our original website, daddyunscripted.com, which is where the blog is and where a lot of these photos that go along with these episodes can be found. I did create a little blog post of photos and words to go along as a companion piece to the Matt Thorne episodes, so you can find those on the website as well. And you can also find us on Twitter at Daddy Unscripted, Instagram, Facebook, all of those things, and you can send me an email at daddyunscripted@gmail.com. I get a lot of those from you guys, and keep them up. That's how I find these people on Twitter and ask them if they're interested. The day that I'm recording this right now happens to be the day before I'm going to a book signing for Bill Walton, and I'm going to give him a card and try to get Bill Walton on the show. So I don't know if any of you know Bill Walton personally, but if you do, maybe you could give him a little nudge as well. I would love to have Bill Walton on this podcast. I think he's perfect, and we could have a great conversation about so many things with Bill Walton. So that is the latest kind of person that most of you will know that I'm trying to reach out and get for the podcast. So we'll see if that happens. I want to also thank Umphreys McGee for the use of their music in all of the Daddy Unscripted podcast episodes. And specifically, I will assure you, all music in this podcast episode is by Umphreys McGee. So anything you're hearing in the background and during the intro and outro, that is all Umphreys McGee, and so good. So thanks again to that band for being so gracious in letting me use their music in the podcast. Stay tuned for the next episode. That should be next week or the week after, and that will be my daddy conversation with Matt and us talking about his relationship with his dad. And it's a lot of conversation that goes through finding your way to being a dad and being able to parent your children through all kinds of life experiences. And for those of you who came here for the first time to listen to the podcast, thank you very much for joining. If you are a Prince fan, maybe you know somebody else who I can have a conversation with. I would love to, as Matt and I were talking about the conversation starter that his book is, I would love to have more conversations with other personalities and other people from different walks of life about the man and the music behind Prince and how he affected myself and other people out there. So keep an eye out for some of those, and thanks again for listening.